Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including Intelligence Squared US, Oxford-style debates live from New York City. Intelligence Squared US brings together the world's leading authorities on the day's most important issues for intelligent discussion grounded in facts and informed by reasoned analysis. Rethink your point of view with Intelligence Squared US. Find it on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll look at the field of Oscar nominees and non-nominees and consider what this field looks like and what it left out. We'll also take a look at the new HBO series, Looking, which is sparking a lot of interesting and sometimes contentious conversations. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I swim in the terrifying seas of movies and TV and theater and pop culture and that sort of thing.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, the Oscars, as we tape this podcast, the nominations were announced almost a week ago. But we, unfortunately, as we noted...
They announced them just in time for us.
They're very badly timed for us. But we did want to take a look at the nominations. And later on in the Oscar season, we will talk about the full rundown of 9 Best Picture nominees, which... I personally am probably the person who has seen the fewest of them, I think, this year. I am running badly behind. So we will do our regular Oscars omnibus another week, but we were going to take this opportunity to talk about some of the things that weren't nominated. And Stephen, do you want to kick us off?
One of the first things that stood out to me about this particular crop of Oscar nominees is particularly when you look at the Best Picture nominees, every single one of them was released in October or later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The as much as it feels like some of the movies that were left out that people thought might be nominated for big, big major awards, like Saving Mr. Banks and Lee Daniels, The Butler, there was a certain amount of like, oh, okay, the Oscars are hip now. You know, they're not necessarily nominating some of the softer, not terribly beloved by critics,
right,
movies,
sure.
And that they went a little bit more toward, like, I had predicted, not on this show, that they were going to not nominate Her for Best Picture, but they were going to nominate Saving Mr. Banks, and this was this was more just a, you know, my fretting than it was accurate. but at the same time, it's very interesting. I think, in a way, a lot of these nominations tap into a trend that's happening in the larger culture, which is just the cycles of these things are getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and thus our cultural memory gets shorter and shorter.
Sure. And I think, you know, I noted when I wrote about the crop of nominees, you know, there are 10 screenplay nominations because there's 5 for adapted and 5 for original. And there are 9 Best Picture nominees, which means 1 Best Picture nominee did not get a screenplay nomination, and that was Gravity, which is
correct.
And then so then you have 8. Of those 10 are 8 Best Picture nominees. The other 2 screenplay nominations to make up that 10 went to
Before Midnight
and
Blue Jasmine. Yeah.
Both of which were summer movies.
Came out earlier. Mm-hmm.
And it really did make me think you can still get consideration. It happens to a few movies. But you do tend to move out of those big major races. And of course, Cate Blanchett was nominated for Blue Jasmine, and so was Sally Hawkins. But other than that, in terms of Best Picture, it just didn't happen.
Yeah.
And I do want to, early in this conversation, recommend to anyone who hasn't read it a piece that Mark Harris wrote on Grantland, which talks about how the expanded field for Best Picture has actually narrowed
I haven't read that, but I had noticed the
number of movies that get major nominations.
Yep.
And, you know, the analysis is speculation up to a point. But what he says is you now have a situation where the Best Picture field is big enough that everybody kind of ignores everything that's not a pretty serious contender for Best Picture. Mm-hmm. It just goes away. And so people don't think anymore in terms of a movie where you might say, Look, I wouldn't nominate anything else about this movie, but I might nominate this one wonderful performance. I mean, remember, Marissa Tomei won for My Cousin Vinny.
My Cousin Vinny, what, that wasn't nominated for Best Picture?
I mean, nobody is going to look at that. That would never happen now. Never. Nobody looks at kind of a goofy movie like that. That's why I think Melissa McCarthy for Bridesmaids a couple years ago was such an anomaly.
Right.
Is it because people
one
really,
that you predicted.
It was. People really don't do that anymore. They think about Best Picture nominees and they take almost all of the major nominations from
Well, let's list some of the movies that were potentially expected to produce an acting nomination that did not.
Right.
Rush for Daniel Brühl.
Uh-huh.
Saving Mr. Banks for Emma Thompson. Lee Daniels, the butler, for Forrest Whitaker.
Oprah Winfrey,
who was very widely expected to be nominated. All is Lost with Robert Redford.
Inside Llewyn Davis. Yeah.
For Oscar Isaac.
Yeah.
And none of them did. There are a couple of movies we have to acknowledge. August Osage County produced. I can't snicker. There are. I'm so far ahead. I'm sorry. Just as an aside, I'm so far ahead. I've decided that I'm going to see all the Best Picture nominees, all the acting nominees, and all the screenplay nominees.
Good for you.
I have two movies left.
Good for you.
One of them is August Osage County, so I can't criticize.
Yeah, that's going to be your war horse, buddy.
Right.
I mean, August Osage County, but August Osage County, as you point out, has two nominated performances and not a lot of other nominations, if any. And no other, not a Best Picture nominee, but two big acting nominations. But that's Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts.
Right.
And I think what's become...
Scrappy up-and-comers.
I think what's become really difficult, and this is what the Harris piece, I think, is so good at pointing out, is that it's all come down to sort of, you pick this group of movies, this clump of, this year, 9 Best Picture nominees, and then everything else just kind of falls out of the conversation completely.
Because people just... I like his argument. He says, you get these giant piles of screeners and you sort them into 2 stacks. The movies you should see because you think they're going to be the top contenders. And then the other stack. And, of course, you never get to that second stack.
Right.
And it happens to us here.
And so the second stack, for a lot of those people, the second stack is where you would have found Fruitvale.
I was just going to say, Fruitvale Station is...
Sadly, Fruitvale is probably one of those, frankly, I have a screener of that I have been meaning to watch. Mm-hmm. And I think the comedy... If you look at a movie like Fruitvale especially, the combination of that factor and the fact that people know it's going to be hard to watch and a difficult, sad experience if you know what that movie's about and you know that it has this tragedy surrounding it. Mm-hmm. If you've got a million other things you could watch / should watch, or you could put on this one that you know is going to be upsetting and make you cry and make you upset, I think he's hit it right on the head.
Yeah, and this closer-than-ever affinity between the Best Picture nominees and the screenplay nominees has meant that category, those two categories, can't act like they used to act as consolation prizes.
Yes.
Right.
This is where you'd catch, for years past, you'd catch the Coen brothers. They'd squeak something out.
Somebody like Spike Jonze would have been the same.
Charlie Kaufman always ended up in that thing because it was too, in many cases, the Charlie Kaufman cases.
Tarantino originally.
Exactly. Too weird. Everybody acknowledged it was great, but it didn't have that gravitas.
Yeah.
And here's a caveat that we have to put in here. The Oscars obviously are a exercise in collective taste. They're an exercise in collective aesthetic. They don't have any kind of illusions of objectivity. I mean, they do. I don't about that.
Right.
But, for example, a movie like American Hustle gets nominated. That movie, I remember coming out of it going, pretty good. Admired the performances. But that movie evaporated on my frontal lobe as soon as it came, like spun sugar.
I had that reaction to Philomena.
I haven't even watched American Hustle yet, and I feel like I've already forgotten it. I feel like everybody talks about it that way.
Right.
Very few people say to me, like, boy, that movie really stuck with me. The way that you'll hear about, like, 12 Years a Slave, or even the visceral parts of Gravity.
Or in my case...
Or her.
Or in my case, Inside Llewyn Davis, a film that I had exactly the same reaction to coming out of it as I did with American Hustle. Well, it was pretty good. But that has just crawled inside my amygdala, mostly because of...
Cleanse amygdala is a frightening place. Full of things that have crawled in there and never come back out.
Because we touched on this before, but Oscar Isaac's performance isn't showy, isn't big. What it is incredibly small and contained. And somebody pointed out, and I can't remember who, that he doesn't actually look other characters in the eye throughout the entire film. He kind of gazes in the space about 3 inches before their nose. And this does something to the performance. It makes you feel incomplete. It injects this mystery into this performance that really stays with you. You wonder why he's not connecting, and then that informs everything around it. So that performance, I really was sad to get overlooked.
Well, you bring up one of the points that I wanted to make, which is how some of the acting nominations are chosen. Now, the caveat that I always like to throw out, we've discussed on this show before, our collective hatred of the word snubs, because it implies that they could have nominated something but just decided not to.
Right.
When in fact, of course, they nominated one of the other great performances.
Right. Right.
You know, there are 5 slots for Best Actor. That means Idris Elba didn't make it. That means Oscar Isaac didn't make it. That means Joaquin Phoenix didn't make it.
Tom Hanks didn't make it.
Means Tom Hanks didn't make it.
For that phenomenal closing scene in Captain Phillips.
Well, he's good all through that movie, except, I mean, the accent was weird.
Well, yeah.
But there are all these great performances that did not get nominated because there are only 5. But to me, one of the things that stood out, sort of the way the recurring thing with a lot of the movies that people thought might get nominated for Best Picture and didn't, is that they're quote-unquote too old. You know,
right.
Fruit Fails way back in July. That's like the Mesozoic.
Yeah.
Is that a lot of those performances that didn't get nominated were not only in films that weren't nominated for Best Picture, but they are also, in their own way, many of them are quiet. The Oscar Isaac performance is not only this very interior performance, but he's not likable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's not a likable character. Robert Redford in All Is Lost, which wow. You talk about a movie that I did not click with in the slightest. It just a quick aside on All Is Lost. They mess with the chronology where it starts very late in the film and then it jumps back 8 days earlier. Mm. The big mystery, boat sinks.
Yeah. And there are certain ones. I'm sorry, are you?
Oh, yeah. But the point I was going to make is that Oscar Isaac is unlikable in that movie. Robert Redford, there's no backstory. It's good acting. It's really good physical acting, but it's not Meryl Streep just, you know, gnawing off chunks of scenery and spitting it across the room. There are these quiet restraint. Julie Delpy in Before Midnight.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a very naturalistic performance.
They both are.
Oh, God, yeah.
But Meryl Streep...
We'll get to that movie in a second.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep, I think one of the reasons that August Osage County didn't merit Best Picture is because it just felt very stagey. It didn't also merit
that didn't work
adapted screenplay, which I would have thought it would, only because it felt very stiff. And every time Meryl Streep finished a giant histrionic speech, I just felt like she was going to turn to the camera and go, "For your consideration."
Yeah.
It was like in Wayne's World, which is Oscar clip underneath.
It's interesting because we wind up talking about sort of some of the movies that everybody expected to get nominations, at least perhaps, and then didn't. And then I find myself, though, also thinking about movies that everybody knew from the beginning had just fallen off the map and nobody talked about them. And I thought about that this weekend because I rewatched a movie called The Way, Way Back, which I really loved. And this is from Nat Faxon and Jim Rash, who did The Descendants with Alexander Payne. And The Way, Way Back is a story of this kid who goes to work at this water park while his mother, played by Toni Collette, is having this disastrous relationship with this terrible boyfriend, played by Steve Carell, who is so good in this movie. And if you've ever doubted that the little element of sympathy that Steve Carell has always been able to inject into all those guys is intentional, you realize that, that's a thing he does.
Yeah,
he knows how to give those guys a little bit of lovability because this guy is terrible. But the point of this being, this movie is absolutely full of these supporting performances that I think are perfect. Sam Rockwell is in this movie, and he is dynamite in this movie. Toni Collette is lovely in it. Steve Carell, as I said, is really good in it. And Allison Janney is in this movie. And if you watch the first 5 minutes of Allison Janney's performance in this movie, when she shows up, comes in, wreaks havoc, and leaves, if you don't watch that and think, I want to watch her in everything she's ever been in, then we are very, very different people. And nobody expected that to get nominated for anything. It came, it went, it made a decent amount of money. It did decently fine for a art housey-ish kind of movie, a sort of mainstream indie, I guess I would call it.
Right.
But it wasn't around. Mm. in those conversations by the end of the year. And I think that's an example of one where the whole movie, I think there are five or six things you could have nominated in that movie, and it was just never in the game. It's just, it's too small. There's not enough room, especially once you start nominating the movie and everything in it.
Right.
As, you know, Best Picture plus everyone in it.
Well, it feels like most of the nominees, one of the ways that I've been able to see almost every major Oscar-nominated movie is there was a total of about 15 contenders from the start. And, you know, and, and people kind of knew that by the end just from, you know, polling Oscar voters and just...
And that's one of the things that Harris talks about in that piece is that you see those 15 or so and you wrap up all the major nominations in anything. Because they took them all from the same...
Yeah, from the same short stack of movies,
Plus his, a couple
The stat he quotes is that the top six categories, picture, director, and the four acting races, represent 11 films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's 11 films.
That's how I'm so far ahead.
Yeah. if we can just inject real quickly the honorary Dame Judi Dench Award for Best 3 Minutes of Screen Time. Alfre Woodard in 12 Years a Slave.
Yes, I agree.
If we could award something for a tiny
best
little
cameo,
then what she does in that film is contextualize all of it. Give us a perspective that we haven't gotten up to that point, which exposes the fact that the brutality we've been watching is not purely physical. We've seen the emotional, we've seen repercussions of it.
It's an incredibly complex part.
It is. Yeah. There's a mystery to that. It's not the screenwriter saying, here's how you should feel now. There is a mystery. There's a self-lacerating quality of that character. There's a real, she's flirting with empathy, but then she ultimately rejects it. Mm-hmm. It's so good. It's so chewy in 3 minutes.
This just in, Alfre Woodard can act.
Yeah.
actually, quick. 12 Years a Slave. No, this is probably where I should point out the stupefying blunder I made on last week's episode. And I'd like to apologize first to you people and then to the listening audience for doing something I hate so much when other people do it, which is I referred to director Steve McQueen, lead actor Chiwetel Ejiofor, referred to them as African-American.
There you go.
Brilliant.
I laugh at this not because so I understand people take it seriously and it bothers people, and I don't mean to make light of that.
It bothers me.
I'm making light of
me.
How mortified Stephen feels. Yes.
They are both British.
And how much he knows that he...
Yeah, they're English, and I'm dumb. And
I
knew it. Anyway.
Well, that's what I said to people. I said, we knew. It's one of those things.
We don't work from scripts, people.
If you speak extemporaneously for an hour a week, you will do things like that. But I'm glad that you apologized, and we are sorry. But speaking of Chiwetel Ejiofor, I have not seen Dallas Buyers Club, as I said last week. I have not seen that movie yet. So I do not draw conclusions about Matthew McConaughey or worthiness
so
of performance.
Good.
I know, but I have to tell you. The idea of that being locked up
for Matthew McConaughey?
For somebody else.
Oh, yeah.
Other than Chiwetel Ejiofor a little bit crazy. Because that's how I feel about that.
But there is this point where you try to rate these movies, and I've seen 8 of the 9. The one I have not seen is Wolf of Wall Street. But it really is like, my number one favorite is apples. My number two favorite is oranges.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Yeah.
Like, do I prefer, 12 Years a Slave or Her?
Well, that's the thing. Is
they're both amazing.
We say this every year, and it's because it's always true, and yet people hate it because it's a little bit like the anti-list-making thing critics do. But it really is true that it brings out the ridiculousness of it when you're thinking about something like, like if they had nominated Allison Janney, would it be her or Lupita Nyong'o from 12 Years a Slave?
Right.
Like, you can't. It's a stupid question.
Well, like it's like choosing between Coldplay's Atlas and Alone Yet Not Alone from the movie Alone Yet Not Alone. I mean, how do you decide?
Yes.
How do you whittle it down?
I can do you one better. In the documentary category, it's 20 Feet from Stardom versus The Act of Killing,
right?
Which is like, let's take this puppy and throw it in a shark tank.
Backup singers versus the actual perperpetrators of a genocide reenacting their genocide for the camera.
And it's not that, it's just that trying to set those things against each other. And there have been some really good debates about this, talking about documentaries and the effect of sort of the artfulness of a documentary versus the importance of the subject. And neither one of those things is to be overlooked. But when you ask a movie that is the best possible documentary about backup singers, even if you asked it to go up against a pretty good documentary about the perpetrators of genocide, which, as I understand, again, I have not seen The Act of Killing
yet. Very stylish movie, actually.
But that I have heard nothing except that it is fantastically artful. I'm just saying, even if it weren't, to try to set those movies against each other is very, very difficult as a
But if
idea.
You're placing your bets in the documentary category, if critics use the adjective searing to describe a documentary, it's got a pretty good chance.
Yeah.
If they use the word joyous, not so much.
Yeah. So if we were to go around the table and close this segment by just real quick talking about Stephen Thompson, if you were going to write a wrong from these nominations, and of course, they're not wrong.
Right.
Nothing wrong. We're just saying, in your ideal world, what would you include or not include? What would you change?
I don't necessarily have a movie. There are several movies that I would put in that 10th Best Picture spot. We've discussed on the show the frustration with when you can nominate 10 movies and you only pick 9. That does feel like a snub. Mm. The one that I would change, the one that really bugged me, is in Best Director. I'm on the record. I really like Nebraska. We will talk more about Nebraska in the Oscars omnibus. Mm-hmm. That is a very good film. It is a very small film. I did not have the experience watching that film like, this is just a masterful feat of directing. If it were an Olympic high dive, it would be a very solid, very small splash. And
good form.
Good form. But I didn't understand why Alexander Payne was just a slam dunk for Best Director for that movie. I like that movie, but it's very small. Compared to Spike Jonze, who not only executed a very, very complex, hard to imagine what that movie's even going to entail concept, and did it in this visually stunning way. I just love that movie. Yeah. I really didn't, that one really bugged me. And it's not like, I hate Alexander Payne. I like Alexander Payne. Right. I just didn't, that's a big switch I would have made.
That's what you would have switched out. Trey Graham.
I have to admit to falling on my face last week with this conversation. I insisted that Sarah Polley was going to get a nomination for Stories We Tell, and lo and behold, she didn't.
Yeah.
So that's the one I would correct. I think, you know, Dirty Wars, I'm sure, is a fine film. I haven't seen it. But it's one of those films that is there because it's important, just in terms of its topicality. So I would say that this wonderfully observed, beautifully structured family story
is much better than this darker movie I haven't seen.
Is the one that I would like to have gotten some more attention.
That, yeah, it's fair to say we would have wiggled it in there somewhere.
Yes.
Glenn Weldon.
In Best Song, you think you know what I'm going to say, but you don't. We've seen Bono get up in front of us and lecture us in his sniper glasses enough, and I think we can swap out that song and put back in Please, Mr. Kennedy from Inside Llewyn Davis.
Isn't that not eligible reason?
I think it is. I think it, because so many of those, like, Fare Thee Well isn't eligible.
I read that it wasn't eligible for some reason.
Rules
but I could
be damned.
Be
just to be able to see.
Like, exactly. To change the rules.
Adam Driver on the stage of the Oscars going, would be worth it. So that's a reason to turn into a musical
If you have
number.
To change the rules, just change them.
Exactly.
There you go. Mine's actually very easy. I've been talking about this Allison Janney performance all day. I love that Allison Janney performance. I like you, Julia Roberts, but not in that movie. So I would just swap out Julia Roberts from August Osage County, who I don't think is doing anything particularly special in that movie. I think she's fine. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and talk to us about what was left out, what movies you loved that aren't in this nominations list that you want to make sure people remember as they think about the best movies of 2013. So our other topic today, HBO recently premiered a new series called Looking. And Looking is about three gay men who live in San Francisco, and it is present day, unlike a lot of sort of gay men in San Francisco stuff where they love to do the kind of period aspect.
There's only one mustache.
A lot of beards, though.
That's kind of what I mean. But
all right, I just want to say I'm so happy that we're finally throwing off the heteronormative yoke of this show and talking about a gay topic, unlike the Tonys, unlike Disney musicals, unlike everything that's come out of Trey Graham's mouth and what's making him happy. That we... Finally, it's our time to shine, Trey Graham.
All right. Well, Glenn, what did you think of? We should say Looking stars Jonathan Groff, who you might know from Glee, and he was in Spring Awakening. And some other lovely things. Yep. What did you think of this show, Glenn?
Well, first we should say that this is the show that has launched 1,000 think pieces all over the internet, all over the press. There's just a commentary from a lot of gay dudes who live in cities, tends to be, commenting about it. And we get a range of reactions. We get this show is just about sex and relationships, and there's more to the gay experience than that. We get the, how can this show not address the legacy of the AIDS crisis and coming out and the pain of the gay experience, quote-unquote. Mostly, though, we got a lot of, this show's boring. A lot of that. And I would say that there is a hesitancy, there is a restraint to this show that borders at sometimes on preciousness. But it really reminds me of the movie that the guy who is writing and directing this, Andrew Haig, he did a movie called Weekend a year or so back.
A movie
I really liked, but I didn't like it at first because it had this same tone, this same very, very narrow focus, more a character study than a big plot-driven thing.
And that's a big tale.
So the people who are comparing this to Sex and the City and to Girls, which it's being compared to a lot, I mean, I think that's just...
And Queer as Folk.
Well, see, that's the thing. I think it's a dead end because no matter what romantic comedies try to tell you, gay men and straight women are not the same. And so let's compare let's compare bananas to bananas and compare it to Queer as Folk and to Tales of the City.
Yes.
And even, let's throw the L word in there, which were, because of their serialized nature, these melodramatic things that just kind of churned the characters through the machinations of plot. The characters got broader and broader, and there was like, yeah, no, I'm secretly your dad, and there's a mad bomber, all this stuff. This is, if it's a melodrama, it's very, very mellow.
It's more mellow than drama.
It seems to me that we're spending a lot of time with these guys, and we're not getting big, we're getting small, and so far, I'm really on board.
Yeah.
I am too.
Interesting. Stephen, what did you think?
Well, it's interesting that you compared it to the L Word and the narrower focus of this show. I mean, if you look at the L Word throughout its run, I mean, that show ran the gamut of the lesbian experience from lipstick lesbians to all the way over to lipstick lesbians with deep voices. and this show is definitely, like, in tone, it is very, very contained. One thing that I wanted to point out about the show that I immediately loved was Jonathan Groff. Mm-hmm. And he does something in the show that characters in shows like these do not do nearly enough, which is smile.
Yeah,
he smiles and laughs.
That's a great point.
He laughs when things are funny.
And his flirtations have that element of smiling with that kind of
He has this slightly squinching about the eyes and a little smile and the sly little smile that makes him a nice audience surrogate, which is clearly part of what he is what he is intended to be.
Yeah. Oh, you know, my reaction to this show, and I have been looking at a lot of these think pieces, these kind of this is boring. As well as the wonderful...
That's a short think piece.
As well as the wonderful Straight Man's Guide to Looking, which they published on Esquire, You know, my friends in college used to say that there was something that was past Clueless where it was actually a clue void. It sucked in clues from other things.
And disposed of them.
And this struck me as kind of a clue void, the Straight Man's Guide to Looking. So we'll link to that and you can draw your own conclusions. The thing that I thought was interesting about it was... I completely get why gay dudes are invested in the idea of how does this present gay dudes and how does it relate to the gay experience. But, you know, is there such a thing as the gay experience?
Exactly.
I mean, I have to assume that right here in this room, Glenn's gay experience is pretty different from Trey's gay experience.
This is true.
And Glenn is married and Trey is not married. And I mean, there's no one gay experience. Mm-hmm. There's not even one gay experience in San Francisco, let alone a gay experience in Idaho. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of these think pieces have sort of said, like, it needs to be bolder. It needs to sort of assume that these guys is it too gay or not gay enough?
And think about that. Think about the amount of weight that gets stacked on a show like this, just the way there's a ton of weight stacked on top of Girls.
That's exactly
where Girls is expected.
Stacked on top of Girls.
That'll always be the dream.
Oh, my God.
But that why is Lena Dunham held accountable when a lot of its faults are exactly the same faults as a lot of other shows?
Exactly. You're going in a narrative, and this is something that I'm stealing directly from the Judge John Hodgman podcast, but specificity is the soul of narrative, he always says. And the idea is not to represent all gay dudes, it's just to be a story about
these
some
gays.
Gay dudes.
These
ones, and to me, the Jonathan Groff character is clearly... You know, I think he's at least as relatable to a young, straight, single dude as he would be to, like, an old gay dude who's been married for 20 years.
Like,
it's
only been married for...
Esquire would disagree with you.
I feel like it doesn't need to be that foreign, and it doesn't mean it doesn't have elements. It's like saying, well, you should talk about this show that is about black people, but don't say anything about race. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
You can talk... That's part of it, but it's not the entire story. And I felt surprised by the way that both certain straight people and certain gay guys seem to think that everyone else is kind of gazing at this from, you know, like you're looking at zoo animals. Like, right. It's, like it's totally, totally foreign to you.
Now, Trey, you've seen the first four.
I've only seen one.
Pilot. Yeah, me too. Okay. One.
So where does it go?
I think it does go. And I've seen arguments to the contrary, and I think they're just flat wrong. I think this thing is very deliberately paced. It's carefully observed, and it's not in a hurry. And I like that about it. The characters come to feel just very comfortably inhabited, and I suspect that's A, some fine acting, but also some really good casting. They made some really good casting choices with these people, particularly in the, I think it's the third episode, there's an older character who enters the mix, played by Scott Bakula, in just this wonderfully laid-back performance.
I just made a Muttley noise. Of course, Scott Bakula also played gay in
Behind the Candelabra,
so I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but it just...
That's true, he did.
No, it's really relaxed and low-key and wonderful, and it introduces the question of aging among an urban gay population in a way that hasn't really been discussed on TV very much.
You know, one of the things that I admired about the pilot was its approach to sex. The writer Alan Gerganis has famously said, he's interviewed all the time, he writes about this a lot, that in American, he's talking about American letters, but in American cinema and American television, there's this puritanical bias. This is a puritanical streak that means as soon as the sex scene starts, we cut to the wafting curtains, and then we cut to the next morning. And what his point is that we American writers or filmmakers tend to see the sex scene as a plot development, not as a dialogue, which is what exactly it is. So if you're a writer and you present a sex scene and you cut away, you are denying me as a reader or as a watcher a chance to for you to reveal something about these characters.
Right.
Not just their abs, but I mean like who
but
they
everybody
are,
does
what
not
they
have
think.
Sex in the same way.
Exactly.
Like every couple does not have sex in the same way.
This is why sex scenes tend to be pretty boring.
The little eyebrow pop, by the way, that Trey just made is my favorite thing that's ever happened on this show.
Because you get the two kind of sex scenes, right? You get the until the 12th of never gauzy curtains, and you also get the cold distance, these people aren't connecting in any way. And there's
shame.
A whole universe there between those two poles.
Yes.
And and we just don't see it. And it seems to me like this idea that he goes cruising and then he has a reaction to that. Mm-hmm. There's how he feels about what he's doing is just as important as what he's doing.
And I thought his reaction was so charming that he had that sort of, like, he sort of thought it was funny. Like that he sort of thought this was a very odd experience that he kind of felt like he was... It almost seemed to be like he sort of thought it was an experience he was supposed to have, and yet he mostly found it really weird and embarrassing, which I think is how many people might react to that, but certainly not necessarily everyone.
Yeah, as you discover more of the show, you will see different representations of sex, and some of them are purely transactional, but even in the first big transactional sex scene that you'll come across, there's a sense of fun and joy surrounding it. Even though it is rather clinical, and that's—I don't want to spoil too much, but
yeah, and it's interesting because this show really, for me, one of the things it brought out was the difference between the obligation of an individual show and an individual creator versus the obligation of a network when it comes to what message you're sending, because it is extremely difficult not to notice that on HBO's show about young women having lots of sex, you see a lot of skin, you see a lot of sex, you see a lot of toplessness, you see a lot of everything. And so you get in that place where it's like, you do feel that need to sort of say, like, how come the girls have to take their clothes off all the time? And in this show, which is about sex, at least in the pilot, you really don't see a heck of a lot of anything. And I resist that reaction because the decisions on girls are made by a specific creator for a specific reason. And you don't want to force all those people to get together and have a committee where they decide how naked people are going to be. And yet I still have that feeling where it's like, I wonder if creators feel the same freedom to make those decisions about it. I don't know. It's very vexing to me because it did stand out a lot how much less explicit it is than Girls for a show that is also about sex about as much as girls is.
Well, to that end, there was one of the criticisms, I think it was the Gawker criticisms, pointed out a scene where the character, Patrick, played by Jonathan Groff, goes to the Folsom Street Fair in, you know, kind of a revealing outfit. Now, Jonathan Groff has a great body, but the writer of this piece expressed incredulity that somebody with such a good body would feel self-conscious. And it's just how you get a good body is to be self-conscious about your body. There's a cause and effect relationship.
That's not knowing.
That's just silly.
Mind-bogglingly obtuse.
I do want to say that once, you know, having watched a few episodes, it becomes rather more than a show about sex. It is really a show about trying to find your exact place in the world.
Right, and I didn't mean it's a show about sex. I mean about sex about as much as girls is, which is to say somewhat.
There's a very nice conversation between these two guys who've been to school together and then have been roommates for a long time until the pilot episode where one of them moves out. It's Patrick, played by Jonathan Groff, and Augustine, and I am afraid I do not know that actor's name. And they're talking about who they think they are and maybe who they really are, and it goes like this.
When was the last time you heard me say that I'm an artist?
I don't know if either of us are very good at being who we think we are. We might have to try a little harder.
And that for context, Patrick is a video game designer. He doesn't always want to be a level designer. Augustine is an artist, but he doesn't actually make any art. And they're at this sort of moment of existential crisis and trying to figure out how they're going to... And this is really the turning point of the first few episodes, I think.
Well, I do encourage folks to read some of what's been written, just because it's interesting to see what reactions it's bringing out in people. There's a piece on Slate that I was so perplexed by because it sort of said, like, you could only be this sort of self-conscious or whatever if you had tried to separate yourself and not learn anything about gay thought. And I sort of thought... Gay thought. What's gay thought?
One thing that this show has massively in common with Girls is that commentary on it is a gigantic Rorschach test.
It's absolutely true. So I do encourage folks to read some of it and to try the show. I think the show is definitely worth watching. There are moments when I think, like Glenn said, that it does sort of brush up against being a little bit boring to me. But that's not because they're gay, and it's not because of how much sex they're having. It's just because I'm not sure there's enough going on in the pilot for my personal preference. But I'm certainly going to keep watching it. It's a good show. It's a good show. So, again, find us on Facebook or on the blog. Let us know what you think, and we'll try to link to some of those pieces so you can sort of read them for yourself and look at this Rorschach test we're talking about. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, in the process of preparing for for having seen all of the major Oscar nominees, one of the films that I caught up with, because it was nominated for Best Screenplay, is Before Midnight. And in preparing to watch Before Midnight, I watched Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. I had seen Before Sunrise a while back, but decided to just mainline the whole trilogy. And those are, you know, I'm not the first person to say that those are wonderfully, wonderfully observed films, but they are, you know, taken collectively a very, very powerful experience. And I had, for some reason, thought going into Before Midnight, like, this is going to be this light, winsome romance. And what you actually get in that film is a bunch of really punishing fighting and a couple that has been together for a long time having a gigantic fight in which they are chronicling all of their resentments. Now, if that doesn't sound like it's for you, I certainly understand. But it was for you. but it is ultimately, though I did not enjoy it the way I enjoy the first two movies, it's a really powerful way of looking at what happens when these romantic decisions are made, these very kind of seemingly capricious romantic decisions are made, that they have gigantic consequences that unfurl over the course of decades. And this movie really understood that and really took no shortcuts in portraying what life will be like. And the fact that they've kind of let it roll out every 9 years like it was a 7-Up movie, where you're seeing, you know, where you're actually seeing how these actors have aged and how these relationships would have aged under the circumstances that they've laid out. I really collectively just love the films.
Thank you. That is a very good choice, Stephen. And I'll just say this one thing, which is the thing I love about those movies is that when you watch the last one, all the things that get them fighting and so embittered toward each other, all those qualities in them were there at the beginning.
Oh my God.
They just seem different.
Just, there's also a certain amount of like what not to do in a fight with somebody you love, like clap.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
There sure is.
As soon as he did that, he kind of did the.
Yeah.
As she's like just giving a spiel, like, you have just lost, dude. You lost.
Yeah. You and I are going to talk a lot more about this. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Well, this is going to be short and sweet because I don't want to be looking's biggest booster, but one of the things we didn't talk about is a really charming performance by the sort of central female in the show. The actress is Lauren Weedman, who was on HBO's Hung. She played Horny Patty, and she plays the roommate of the oldest of the central threesome, and it's just a really charming performance. It's funny. It's really well written. The dialogue they write for her, and I don't know how much of it is improvised. I kept finding myself thinking she's probably just riffing there. She's a smart actress. I've seen her in two or three different things, and the chemistry that she and this other character have, Dom, is just a really nice thing to watch, and I look forward to watching it develop.
Wonderful. Thank you, Trey Graham. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Warner's Home Entertainment announced this week that the 1966-1968 television show Batman is being released finally on DVD after over 20 years of rights kind of going back and forth, because it had so many guest stars that negotiating the rights to that was just took forever. No word on when it's coming out, no word on format, but this is capital I important. Even if you happen not to be writing a book about the intersection of nerd culture and the character of Batman, this show is a Rorschach blot. It's a skeleton key. It's a litmus test, because when you're a kid, you love the show. When you're an adolescent, you hate the show because you think it is making fun of this character that you love. When you're an adult, you understand that all it's doing is taking the comics of the day and transposing them directly. It's got a reputation for being campy and over the top, but in fact, it is just saying, let's play this straight. That's the genius of the show. That's where the humor comes in. And the reason it's so important to nerd culture, I argue, is that there's a huge contingent of nerds, hardcore Batman nerds, who hate this show because they're trapped in a perpetual adolescence that appreciates the existence of nuance, but rejects it out of hand and cannot embrace anything that is not, this is the worst thing ever, this is the best thing ever. You have written about this eloquently before. This idea that nerd culture insists upon itself in such a way, and its opinions in such a way, as to obliterate nuance and only allow two polar opposite views. But even if, leaving all that aside, that's chapter 8, by the way. Leaving all that aside.
Chapter 8, the end of nuance.
Exactly.
By Glenn Weldon.
This is just such a fun show. It's such a great looking show. It is such a culturally important show. And Victor Buono is King Tut. You're not going to get better than that. He's so good. So it's coming out. Don't know when. I will keep you posted.
I bet you will. Well, those of you who read the blog have read a little bit about this already, and Stephen has certainly been subjected to it already. But the thing that has been making me happy is that after weaning myself off of American Idol for several seasons, really, where I only kind of dipped in and dipped out, it's really fun again. I hate to say that, but they've reconstituted the judging panel. They kept Keith Urban, who was on last year. They brought back Jennifer Lopez, who had been gone, in favor of Mariah Carey and Nicki Minaj fighting, which someone thought was charming. And they have brought in, most delightfully of all, Harry Connick Jr., who had been a guest mentor a couple times and really impressed people with his willingness to be kind of bracingly honest with these young performers, especially about my bugaboo, which is he has a thing about saying, just sing the song. You don't have to decorate it with a bunch of different. He knows the difference between people who know how to imitate the radio and people who are musicians. And he does not fall for the idea that because a lot of it is young women, because she has listened to enough people on the radio to know what a kind of radio voice is supposed to sound like, he doesn't mistake that for being a good singer. And he will tell them, you're not a good enough singer. And when you hear somebody actually say to somebody on that show, you're not a good enough singer, it's actually pretty great.
Well, they also whittled out so much crap. They whittled out the sob stories. They whittled out the meanness. Yeah. Let's bring out people who are not necessarily capable of exhibiting the proper judgment going on this show. They've just taken that out. Yeah. And now it's are you a not good enough singer or are you a good enough singer?
So basically what happened is I watched the screener of the first episode of the season. And then I got in touch with Steven and I said, look, I said, I know you've specifically been really happy about not watching this show anymore. Yes. But I really want you to watch it with me because it's really fun. And so Steven gave in and watched the first episode of the season with me. And I was very happy because it was a, sort of a renewal of an old ritual that had decayed. And it made me very happy. So that's what's making me happy.
The problem is I didn't want to be pulled back in. But it is a massively, like, everything I ever... You didn't even mention Steven Tyler, who really needs to jump into a volcano.
That's true.
And so they just took out everything I hated.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I've been enjoying it a lot more. And you can try it out for yourself and see whether, of course, once the season gets underway, I am proved wrong. But I'm hoping not. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham exactly like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Lauren McGaughey, at L Migaki, MIGAKI. And you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including Intelligence Squared US, Oxford-style debates live from New York City. Intelligence Squared US brings together the world's leading authorities on the day's most important issues for intelligent discussion grounded in facts and informed by reasoned analysis. Rethink your point of view with Intelligence Squared US. Find it on iTunes under Podcasts.